The Healthy Planet radio program is coming up, and you're listening to WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook.
Love is but a song we sing. Fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing and you may not know why. When the one that left us yet returns for us at last, we are but a moment's sunlight fading in the grass. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together.
And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. Something that all of us want. It's been about a month now since the election that had the country holding its collective breath. Those on both sides were holding their breath. And as we learned a few weeks ago, and as has now been confirmed by over 40 court decisions across the country, by states, and now by the Supreme Court, there is no evidence that there's anything but certainty that the new president-elect is Joe Biden. In terms of the health and environmental issues that I've been covering in my nonprofit work with Healthy Planet, and that we've discussed on this show for many years, from climate change to destruction of our natural resources and biodiversity, to pollution, pollution-related deaths, and much more, a change in our country's leadership in 2020 was critically important. The past 4 years were in a league of their own in terms of actions taken against our life support system. How bad was it? Well, the League of Conservation Voters that has rated members of Congress on environmental, public health, and energy issues since the 1970s said this. I quote, "No elected official has ever posed a bigger risk to our environment and our health than Donald Trump. And he clearly deserves the title, dirtiest of all time." End quote. So now it's cleanup time. Despite losing seats, the Democrats still control the House of Representatives. The Senate's makeup is dependent upon the runoff election in Georgia coming in January. And for the presidency, despite the incessant failed legal challenges and claims of voter fraud, Joe Biden's victory was indeed decisive. Keep in mind that in 2016, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton with an electoral vote margin of 74. At the time, Donald Trump repeatedly called that victory a landslide. In 2020, Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by exactly the exact same 74 electoral vote margin. So even by Donald Trump's accounting, the 2020 election was a landslide. But that Electoral College landslide was only half the story. The other half, as you will recall, is that in 2016, Donald Trump actually lost the popular vote by a little less than 3 million votes. So he lost the popular vote. In 2020, on the other hand, Joe Biden won the popular vote by 7 million voters. Again, quite decisive. Those of us who are environmental voters are now anxiously waiting to see just how well the new administration will make up for 4 years of very precious lost time following the reign of Donald Trump and given the current makeup of Congress. And that brings us to the topic of our show, which is, what's next for climate change and clean air policies under the incoming administration? Given the urgency of addressing climate change now, before the most extreme impacts become irreversible, how much and how fast can Joe Biden turn this large ship around? And our guest today, David Doniger, is ultimately qualified to answer these questions, as he's been at the forefront of the battle against air pollution and global climate change since he joined the National Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, in 1978. And that was before the environment was considered a partisan issue. He is the Senior Strategic Director of Climate and Clean Energy Programs with the NRDC. He helped formulate the Montreal Protocol, an international agreement designed to stop the depletion of the Earth's ozone layer, as well as several essential amendments to the Clean Air Act. In 1993, he left the NRDC to serve on the White House Council on Environmental Quality, followed by key posts at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He rejoined NRDC in 2001 and has since been working to defend the Clean Air Act from assaults in Congress and is based in Washington, D.C. in order to do that best. All right, David, thank you for joining us on The Healthy Planet. The Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, works to safeguard the Earth, its people, its plants and animals, and the natural systems on which all life depends. And they are a force to be reckoned with, as they combine the power of more than 3 million members and online activists with the expertise of some 700 scientists, lawyers, and policy advocates across the globe to ensure the rights of all people to the air, the water, and the wild. Now, David, you have a long history with the NRDC. First, describe the role that you currently play there and anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners about this huge organization.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here. NRDC has been around since 1970, and you've described what we do. It's on behalf of the members that we advocate for clean air, for climate protection. We advocate in front of federal agencies. We push for new laws and protect old laws in the Congress. We go to court when the government doesn't follow the law. And I'm a lawyer with the group. I've been with NRDC twice in my career since 1978, with 8 years off for good behavior in the EPA and the Clinton administration.
So you went from being with the NRDC to being in government and EPA and back to the NRDC.
Correct.
You've got a long history. You're like the tree ring of the environmental movement. You have recorded the full history, as the tree rings have recorded the weather, the temperature, the atmosphere for the years that the tree was alive. You're our living record, and it's great to have you as a resource in that sense.
Unfortunately, the level of carbon in the atmosphere keeps increasing throughout my career.
Unfortunate indeed.
I worked on more conventional air pollution issues. I worked on the treaty to protect the ozone layer, which has eliminated the CFCs that were destroying the stratospheric ozone.
And the impacts of that are enormous.
Yes. Not only have we avoided millions and millions of skin cancer cases and deaths, but the CFCs were also very powerful climate-changing pollutants. And so getting rid of them is probably the single biggest thing we've done so far to slow climate change.
And you did that work at a time when very few people even knew that climate change was an issue to be reckoned with. And you're going into a bit of the history, so I'm actually going to ask you to go there in a little bit more depth. Because okay. Our listeners to this show are of all ages and backgrounds and likely all political affiliations. And as we know, at this point, our country is sharply divided along partisan lines. So in the hopes of having us at least get on the same page on this program in terms of what the environmental movement is, where it's come from, I'm going to ask you to take a few minutes to create some context for the conversation. Take us on a brief trip through the history of the climate change and clean air movement. And you can start wherever you see fit and bring us right up to the beginning of the Obama administration. And while you're giving us those highlights, let us know the role that you were playing related to those issues at those times.
Well, I want to start in the 1960s when I was still, you know, in junior high and high school. But in that period of time, Americans were waking up to the smog in the cities and the pall of pollution that would settle on their clothing and their windowsills overnight. You know, if they had clothing hanging on the line, it would be dirty in the morning. There were rivers catching fire. And there was an upwelling of concern in the 60s over the pollution that we were living with. And it culminated in the passing of the 1970 Clean Air Act, really a landmark piece of legislation. There were other environmental laws in the years just before and after. So it was a very active period with Congress passing these landmark laws. And on climate change, actually the early signals of concern about climate change were coming forward even then in the 60s. In fact, there's a message from President Lyndon Johnson to the Congress asking for new clean air legislation, in which he singles out, among other things, carbon dioxide, which is overheating the planet.
Well, that's something.
So even back in the middle 60s, scientists were advising the president, and the president was telling Congress that climate change from carbon dioxide pollution was a real problem, and he asked for authority to address it. Now, Congress passed the Clean Air Act of 1970, and it included the authority to protect not only against smog and other kinds of visible ground level air pollution, but it also included the authority specifically to protect against adverse effect on the climate. So the authority has been there since 50 years ago to address the pollution that drives climate change. Now, it wasn't used in the 70s or the 80s. The EPA at that time was focused on smog and soot pollution and did enormous good in cleaning up the cars and power plants and factories for that kind of pollution. But in the late 1980s, we began to see the scientific community really coming to the front and saying that the world was overheating, that the climate was changing, was being driven by carbon dioxide, by other greenhouse gases, and we needed to do something about it. The first President Bush negotiated with other countries a treaty called the Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992, but he didn't do anything to address American carbon dioxide emissions. We did at that time, actually in the late Reagan administration, enter another global treaty to phase out chlorofluorocarbons, the CFCs that used to be in aerosol sprays, and they're also found in all kinds of air conditioning and refrigeration, and replace them with more benign alternatives. Those chemicals that hurt the ozone layer also were really powerful climate-changing pollutants. So it was a big plus on the side, so to speak, to reduce climate risk by protecting the ozone layer. But apart from that, nothing much was done on the problem of climate change, even through the first Bush administration when the first treaty was reached. It was in the Clinton administration that further efforts to negotiate a more effective, more powerful treaty began. And at the end of the Clinton administration, and I served in the EPA at that time, the EPA took the position that the Clean Air Act actually addressed climate change all the way back to that 1970 legislation, and that if the EPA made findings that the greenhouse gases endangered public health and endangered welfare, then it would be obligated to regulate those pollutants. That began the ping pong that we've had since then on this issue as we go from Democratic to Republican administrations and back again. In the second Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, the White House ordered EPA to reverse that position. And then there was litigation over this that went to the Supreme Court. And in a case called Massachusetts versus EPA, the court ruled 5-4 that the Clean Air Act always has covered carbon dioxide, just like any other air pollutant, carbon dioxide, just like carbon monoxide or sulfur dioxide. They're all chemicals. If they're emitted into the air and they endanger our health or the environment around us, then the EPA has obligations to limit the pollution from cars, power plants, other sources that emit them. The Obama administration took action under that law and under that court opinion to issue standards for the emissions from cars and trucks, and also for power plants and some other kinds of industrial activity. Then came the Trump administration. And
here we are.
They have gone about rolling back each of those Obama measures. You know, they're not very competent at this rollback effort. I like to say, imagine where we would be if they knew what they were doing.
That's actually a question I was going to ask you is, we know what they've done to the environment, but have they done it in a way that can stick? Because some of the commentary about the Obama administration was that they created changes that were easily reversed. How about Trump?
Well, it's turned out that the Trump administration has had more trouble reversing the Obama regulations than perhaps they intended or bargained for. First of all, they're just not very good at it. And they failed to follow basic ground rules, rule of law ground rules, that any administration has to follow. If you want to issue regulations, you have to propose them. You have to give people a fair opportunity to comment. You have to listen to and analyze and respond to all those comments. And then you publish a final decision. And then it gets tested in court if somebody's unhappy. And that's true whether you're trying to build new regulations up or tear them down. You have to follow the same process. The Obama administration regulations, those that actually got tested in court right to the end, those were upheld. There were things that were still being litigated at the time the Trump administration came in. And they tried to turn them around. They tried to take them back from the courts and say, we're going to roll this back. They just weren't very good at it. They tried to do several things immediately and skipping the procedures. And they got slapped down by the courts for doing that. And then when they tried to follow the right procedures, they just weren't very clear about what their objectives were. They're taking positions which are very hard to justify under the law. They're taking positions which have no factual basis. And so it was really hard for them to put together the detailed reasons behind doing nothing or behind going backwards. So their explanations are all weak and filled with, you know, the same kind of close regard for the facts that you see from the president's Twitter account.
Yeah, so hard to imagine.
And they were slow. So things that a competent administration could get done in 1 and 2 years, it's taken them 3 and 4 years. And yes, they've done a huge amount of damage, but most of that can be reversed because the cases challenging what they're doing are still pending. And the new administration will come in and be able to say to those courts, please pause these cases. we intend to review, and probably we're going to revise and reverse those things. And we're going to issue new standards for cars, for power plants, for oil and gas, methane emissions, for HFCs, which are the successors of the CFCs. We're going to do all these things. And then there could be new litigation, obviously, later when the Biden administration has had its say. I would just expect that the new administration would be more competent, more careful. And obviously, since they're trying to go in the direction that's supported by the science and supported by the law, they're going to have an easier time than the present Trump team has had.
But because the Trump team was not using science, they had to resort to other measures. They had to find ways for those outside the scientific community to undercut the science supporting EPA decisions. They had to put in appointees that were just not there with the public's best interest in mind.
Right. So, well, let me give you examples of things that they tried. If you're issuing standards for a pollutant, you have to develop a scientific basis of what damage it does. And you also have to assess the cost of reducing it, of limiting it. You have to assess also the economic value of the damage that it's doing. And the Obama administration attempted to develop a method of determining what the benefit is of curbing carbon dioxide pollution. You know, each ton of carbon dioxide, they said, it's worth about $40 of benefit to curb it. One of the key propositions was, look, this pollution spreads all over the world. Our pollution goes everywhere else. Everybody else's pollution comes to us. So we should look at the damage that a ton of our carbon dioxide emissions does, not just to the United States, but the total damage it does to everybody in the world. And because we want everybody else to pay attention to the damage they're doing to us.
Sure.
So we need to pay attention to the damage we're doing to everybody else. The Trump administration came in and said, no, we need to imagine that there is a hermetically sealed wall. That's another kind of wall, right? Yeah. Around the United States, and the air doesn't move out of the United States, and the air doesn't come in from anywhere else. And so we're only going to look at the damage that our pollution does inside our own country. And we're not going to pay attention to the damage we do to others. And implicitly, we don't care about the damage that their pollution is doing to us. It would be as though we were neighbors and I threw my trash into your garden and you threw your trash into my garden. And then both of us wondered why our gardens were full of trash. So we have to pay attention to the global consequences of this global pollution. And I think it'll be quite straightforward for the new administration to return to that view and to scrap the view that the Trump administration took, this blinkered view, which in fact one court has already thrown out. So that's an example of just fooling with the science in a more sophisticated way than the president does. But when you account for all the damage that this pollution does to us and to our neighbors, then it becomes a very big number. It's a much bigger number than the cost of controlling the pollution. So whether you're looking at this just from the standpoint that it's immoral to pollute this way and cause this kind of damage, or you're an economist looking for the costs and the benefits, the answer comes out the same way, that it's important to curb this pollution.
And that's the really important point that makes this really hard to understand at first glance, and that we've been watching this for years, that when you take into consideration the health impacts, tens to hundreds of thousands of people dying per year in the United States, 4+ million in the world. And then you look at the future impacts of climate change, both the enormous cost and the human toll, which is unfathomable. And then you look at the cost of the pollution itself, the water pollution in our lands. And you put that all together and the benefits of the clean energy in terms of the price in many cases, when you factor in all of these externalities. And then you add to that the overwhelmingly beneficial job creation that's available from clean energy and efficiency, And then add to that the fact that the world is moving toward clean energy. And if we are going to be world leaders in a technology that's growing, not shrinking like the fossil fuels, now is the time to act. But even with all that, they still choose and promote and lie about the benefits of fossil fuels, the dirty energy that's killing us. They still choose the dirty fuels. It's kind of mind-boggling, hard to figure out, unless there's the short-term profit for very specific dirty energy industries alone is much more important than any kind of reason.
The Trump administration has been filled with fossil fuel lobbyists and defenders and protectors. They came in at a time when the transition to cleaner energy, purely on economic grounds, let alone taking into account pollution, was beginning to pick up steam. So coal has been losing its market advantage, its market position, because it's being outcompeted not only by natural gas, but also by wind and solar and energy efficiency. Cleaner energy is beating coal out of the marketplace, and soon it will do the same thing to natural gas. So the Trump administration has been trying to prop up these old fuels with all sorts of regulatory advantages or subsidies, including not having to pay any attention to the damage that the pollution from these energy sources is causing. I think the new administration's really going to focus on the promise, the economic promise of clean energy. This is where the jobs are. President-elect Biden said that where Trump sees climate change as a hoax, he sees climate change as jobs.
Right. On that note, we're going to take a two-minute break, and we'll be back with David Doniger of the NRDC on the Healthy Planet radio program 90.1 FM, Stony Brook.
Hi, this is Rob, Docus, Abby, Chris, Anastasia, and we are WUSB's Student Executive Board.
We hope our listening family and all our Stony Brook University classmates and families are managing well in this precarious time.
We are all home, but helping WUSB stay on the air remotely so we can keep you entertained and informed each day.
For only $5 per month or $60 per year, you can join WUSB's family of radio supporters, enjoy special members' benefits, and get a cool radio thank you gift.
Please help us stay on the air by calling 631-632-6901 or toll free at 1-888-632-9872 or online at wusb.fm/pledge.
WUSB, the most dangerous station in the nation.
Again, those numbers are 631-632-6901, toll-free at 1-888-632-WUSB, or online at www.wusb.fm/pledge. Thank you.
And if you do call and get voicemail, leave a message and someone will get back to you. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio program on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook, New York. I'm here speaking to David Doniger, Senior Strategic Director, Climate and Clean Energy Program with the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC. David, I don't know if you're a television talker, but when I've been watching the debates over the years and I hear the candidates, both Republican and Democratic, speaking about climate change and clean energy, there are just so many very strong talking points that they could bring up. And yet, granted, it's getting better. It got better under Obama. Hillary wasn't so strong in some of her answers. And Biden's doing a pretty good job, but still not the pointed responses that pull it all together, like in talking about how it is entirely a win-win situation in every way, and that there's only one loser should we shift, and that we plan to take care of the people employed by the losers when we do move to a new energy model in this country.
Well, that's the thing. And I think that the president-elect is really focused on working not just with the environmental community, but with labor.
Absolutely.
And with rural communities and with the places and the people which are affected by climate change, but also the places and the people that are dependent on the industries that have been driving this kind of pollution. So the task is to bring those parts of the country into the new and clean energy economy. And we can do it. We owe it to those parts of the country. We owe it to those people, to include everybody, and we can do it. the current administration just has had no interest in doing it.
Right. No interest. Because if you look at the number of jobs created by clean energy compared to the number of jobs created by fossil fuels, it's not even close. And then you put energy efficiency into the mix. And on Long Island and other areas that do not themselves mine coal or
drill for oil or hydrofrack for gas,
it's probably 10 times as many jobs. People putting up solar panels, people insulating homes, compared to pumping the oil out of the ground and putting it into our oil burners.
You know, places like Pennsylvania are, have 1 foot in the new economy and 1 foot in the old economy.
Yeah.
And they're making the transition. And there is public support in Pennsylvania, as manifest in this election, for moving forward with the new energy, clean energy economy. It's still incumbent on all of us to help the communities that have been dependent on the old to make it into the new world.
Absolutely. And it's great to see that there's an understanding of our responsibility to create jobs for people who are in fossil fuels today and whose industries are going to be winding down in the decades to come. You don't read a clean power plan, whether it's from the Democratic Party or the Green Party, that does not include something about providing jobs for those whose jobs will be left behind. And that's great to see. That's an accomplishment.
Yeah.
Now, one of the reports that we've often quoted here is the U.S. government's National Climate Assessment. The last one was done in 2018. It's said to be our government's most definitive scientific report on climate change. The head of the program that produced that report is Michael Cooperberg. As part of the great purge we're seeing by President Trump, Cooperberg was removed from his position. And this continues a pattern of firing experts in climate science and appointing those who are even known to stand against the actual aims of the agencies, such as NOAA or the EPA. You know, we've seen Wheeler, who's a coal lobbyist, and Pruitt, who don't have the best interest of the American public in mind. So the question is, you know about all the legal aspects of this. Is there anything that the Biden administration can do to stop future presidents from appointing people who are unqualified, unfit, or even malintentioned to run agencies that are there to protect Americans?
Well, I think the Biden administration is going to focus on getting first-class people into these positions. There's two kinds of positions. There's the political appointees, cabinet-level people and assistant secretary-level people they're always, in every administration, there are political appointees chosen by the incoming president. And Biden and Harris will be replacing the upper strata of all of these agencies with people who are first-class scientists and experts and people who are in touch with community needs. And it's going to be diverse. It's not just going to be a bunch of old white men.
Yeah.
But it's also going to be filled with expertise and commitment. Now, at the level of the civil service, the gentleman who you referred to, who's been ousted from his position running the National Climate Assessment, he's still got a job in the Energy Department, and he might well be reshuffled back into that position in a couple of months. If not him, somebody else of great merit, I'm sure, will be tasked to run the next version of the National Climate Assessment. You know, the civil service protections are really important to protect expertise in government and prevent what we used to have in the 1800s, you know, you would replace every postal clerk and postmaster and every office holder was, a partisan hack from one party or the other. And you'd throw all the bums out and replace them with new bums. Who helped you in your campaign. The civil service protections were instituted in the last century to create a more professional and secure career public servant service that is immune from those political sweeps. Okay. And has some continuity and some expertise. Now, the Trump administration, just before the election, unveiled an attack on those protections. So if he had a second term, I would have been really worried that people who who made their career working for the EPA or the Energy Department or these other agencies and are dedicated public servants, bringing their expertise to bear, no matter who's in charge politically, that there would be some stability and core and dedication to facts, those people would all be imperiled. They could be fired at will. You go back to the 1800s, you know, sweeping out the Republicans whenever the Democrats came in, or the Democrats whenever the Republicans came in. And it just has a horrible effect on the professionalism and capacity of our government. I think the Biden administration will fully respect these traditional civil service protections, and they will install people of quality and dedication and expertise at the tops of the agencies. Beyond that, it's up to us to make sure that we don't elect again someone who would throw all these norms aside.
Hmm. What kind of damage can he do in that respect in the last weeks that he has here?
Well, most of the regulatory changes, if they get finished, they can get reversed. Personnel reassignments can get reversed. The budget is set by Congress. There have been efforts by the Trump administration to savage the EPA budget every year for the 4 years, and the Congress, even when it was in the control of the Republicans, rejected those budget cuts. So there's been some insulation for the institutions. You know, I would be more worried about whether the president decided to bomb someplace than rules changes they could make in the last 2 months, because that kind of stuff, bad as it may be, can be fixed.
That's good. And it's sad that we even have to talk about this, but obviously we're watching something historic happen where things are not going the way they usually do. And that brings us to another question, is that you would think that the protection of the air that we breathe, the water that we drink, the lands that grows our food would be something that all would support. We want that. We want that for ourselves. We want that for our families. We want that for future generations. However, those issues have become politicized. So it's predominantly just one of the two major parties that has made it their position to fight against these protections. And in this past administration, it was just a directed onslaught against our life support system. You have the history to know. When did this become politicized and why? Because in the early days, the environment was not political. It was a bipartisan issue. So where did that shift happen and why did it happen?
Well, I think it's a more general phenomenon than just about environment. I'll come back to that. It used to be that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party sort of ideologically overlapped. There were a lot of conservatives in the Democratic Party, and there were liberals and moderates in the Republican Party. Some of it was regional. The regional Northeastern Republicans tended to be more moderate and liberal back in the 60s and 70s than they were in some other parts of the country, like Orange County, California. And the Democrats in the South were far more conservative than the Democrats in the North. There's been a realignment. You know, I mean, it started with Richard Nixon, the Southern strategy, a reaction to Lyndon Johnson's embrace of the civil rights movement. It became, quite frankly, a way to move Southern conservatives from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. Hmm. And similar things have happened in other regions. Basically, the moderate to liberal people in the Northeast are just not Republicans anymore. They choose to be independents or Democrats. So there's a realignment and a sorting out of the two parties. Now it's been helped and pushed by some, I would think, quite nefarious interests, the Koch brothers and the network of right-wing dark money that has helped to sort of create an alliance between big business wanting to avoid pollution regulation and other kinds of regulation, and sort of grassroots conservatism that may be more focused on issues like abortion or lifestyle choices. And they found this way of building a Republican Party brand that, you know, to which those kinds of people gravitated. And then the Democratic Party has become more diverse, the party of liberal white people and people of color. And the parties just don't much overlap anymore. It may have a lot to do with the changes in the media. Everybody used to watch the same three news networks.
True.
Now there's a good part of the country that watches MSNBC and they never watch Fox, and Fox watchers never watch MSNBC. So there's a lack of communication, and we're in our own echo chambers, and the media environment has segmented us all. There's even a kind of a physical sorting where people choose what part of the country they want to live in part on political and cultural affinities. I don't know how to unwind this, but it does turn out that even among conservatives, they're as you say, they're people want clean air. They don't want to be breathing dirty air or drinking dirty water. And if you can get past the climate or pollution science denial, and people actually see the harm, then you find that the support for action on this dangerous pollution is actually pretty broadly shared. Let me make one point about this. For quite a while, you know, certainly in the 60s, but well into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, climate change seemed kind of abstract and future far off to most people. Mm-hmm. You can't see carbon pollution in the same way that you can see smog or soot. And it's only in the last 10 years or so that, unfortunately, that we're beginning to see the actual manifestations of wildfires, hurricanes, floods, torrential rains, heat waves, changes in the patterns that both directly hurt people and that people can notice and see that, oh, this is different. This isn't the way it was when I grew up. And they become more aware. This becomes more here and now. And that makes people more open to the understanding that if we don't deal with it, it's going to get worse. You know, I wrote a piece a few years ago called Climate Change is Changing the Politics of Climate Change. As this becomes here and now and something you see outside your window and feel, then the support level, the interest level, the anxiety goes up. And you see it this year in the enormous number of activists, especially the young, but not only the young, who are concerned about climate change. And you see it in the fact that in all of the debates this year, the climate change and clean energy questions came up. It's no longer a little novelty. And it's a central element of the Biden-Harris, was part of their campaign and of their plan for governing. He talks about the four crises, and climate change is one of the four crises on which he's focused: the coronavirus, the racial crisis, the economic crisis, and the climate crisis. So I am hopeful that even though it's rather late, and even though there's an awful lot of damage that we can't avoid, I am hopeful that people were ready to act, because there's a whole lot more damage coming that we can avoid. And the world, the choices we make in the next few years are going to determine whether the world that our children and grandchildren live in is habitable or horrible.
Yeah, we dodged a bullet just now, because I think most of the people who voted probably don't understand this, that another 4 years under policies like we're experiencing right now would have been deadly to a crisis that the best experts say is time sensitive. It's urgent.
Yeah. We would have lost, I mean, incompetent as they are, if they had 8 years, they could do a lot more damage than with four. They could, you know, I have acquaintances who work in the Environmental Protection Agency or the Justice Department. And I know many of them have said, well, I can stick this out for 4 years and see how it goes and protect the mission and the knowledge and the integrity of this organization.
Right.
But I wouldn't expect them to be able to stick it out for 8 years. Mm. You know, so that even if they weren't fired, the current president could achieve his objectives just by making it so awful that they would leave.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we're going into a new administration. We know we've got a new president, vice president. We know that the House of Representatives is staying Democratic. The Senate is uncertain. Will that hinder the Biden-Harris ability to get changes made in this area?
Well, we do need to see how the Georgia runoff elections come out.
Mm-hmm.
Whichever way they come out, the new administration has articulated a lot of legislative proposals. I think they'll be looking to see if they can get some Republicans to come across the aisle and support, because it's not just about, you know, some isolated issue of environment. These are all now integrated into the near-term crisis of the coronavirus and the collapse of the economy. How do we build the economy back? And we would argue that there's a lot of good economic sense in clean energy investments and in changes to help our economy and our infrastructure move, really just accelerate the direction in which things are going to create new jobs and create new livelihoods that in a way that are just safer for our health and our climate. So we'll have to see how much of that can get done through legislation. In the meantime, the president-elect and the vice president-elect have the body of existing law, like the Clean Air Act. And it's their job to administer that and to do what they can with it. To be sure, the Supreme Court is more conservative, but I think even that court is not going to ignore what's happening outside the windows of the court. You see, even last term, a very important decision with the opinion written by Justice Gorsuch about LGBTQ rights under a 1964 civil rights law, where he held that sex discrimination prohibitions apply to, you know, discrimination against gay people in the workplace. This is undoubtedly not something that was expressly stated by the Congress of 1964, but he read the words of the statute to encompass that kind of protection. And the same thing is true with words in laws like the Clean Air Act. If Congress has told EPA to protect us from dangerous air pollutants and to use the best system of emission reduction that's available, those are terms which I hope the courts will interpret to allow the agency to do the best job it can in the most, you know, cost-effective and sensible way, and not trap EPA into, you know, doing things that are inflexible or stupid, or prevent them from acting at all.
Right. Yeah, I was a little concerned with Amy Coney Barrett and her response to the questions about climate change, how she seemed to unwittingly let it out that she considered it to be a not settled issue that was very contentious. So,
well, to give her slight benefit of the doubt, it's possible that she could have been thinking that the policy questions surrounding climate change are disputed rather than the science itself.
That would be
And we'll have to see how she and the other new members of the court approach this sort of thing. Now, I go back to 2007, and Chief Justice Roberts wrote a dissent in the Massachusetts versus EPA case, the case holding that the Clean Air Act does cover the pollution that causes climate change. And he wrote a dissent, which was based on the idea that states and the environmental groups had not shown that they were really harmed in a way that gives us what's called standing to bring this lawsuit. I think it would be impossible for him to write that opinion in 2020 or 2025, when cases might come up involving Biden administration regulations, because it's just so obvious now that the impacts of climate change are real and they are upon us. They're not just something that could be dismissed back in 2007 as speculative. You know, I think the scientists have been right for a long time, but now the chickens have come home to roost in ways that we can see it.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've always known that once that happens, it would be more likely that they would see it. But unfortunately, once that happens, it's getting way late. So here we are.
Yeah. Well, the best time to have dealt with climate change would have been 50 years ago, but the second best time is now.
The second best time is now. Agreed. On that note, we're running out of time. So, David, thank you so much. And look, to all of us who have been working on a local, regional level, to see you up there doing your job the way you're doing for all these years, and with the major accomplishments you've achieved, you're a hero. Really appreciate all you do, fighting where the actual fight is taking place.
Well, don't sell yourself short, because talking to people about this through the radio and through the other efforts, you know, this is critical, because the difference when people are engaged versus when there's just a few people trying, you know, tilt at windmills is enormous.
Yep. And you have to change the public perception of something before it's going to be adopted by our government. And that's been a process.
The kids are engaged. The kids are angry. And they're going to be here longer than I will. I tell them, don't forget that you've got a lot of friends in all age groups, and we all need to work together.
Yeah.
But I am so encouraged by the engagement of younger people and the broader engagement of people of all different backgrounds who see what's happening and how it hurts them. And they're asking for change.
Absolutely. And their numbers are growing, because unlike older people whose numbers are finite, their numbers are increasing every day, and they're becoming voting age as well.
So, right.
All right. David, again, thank you for joining us. Keep up the good work.
Now.
We'll be watching.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
And this is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio program, WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook, New York. We've been talking to David Doniger, Senior Strategic Director, Climate and Clean Energy Program with the NRDC. That's the Natural Resources Defense Council. You can find out more about them, as well as a slew of other helpful information about the issue, at nrdc.org. That's nrdc.org. And the next time I'll be with you is Friday, January 1st, 2021, at 6 p.m. the same time. For more information on Healthy Planet or our radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your group or school, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. Also, like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. That's at Healthy Planet USA. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and the Healthy Planet shows every week at this time, with great hosts sharing cutting-edge health and environmental information. Again, every week at this time, Fridays at 6 p.m. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard, even though the political, social situation is a bit rough right now. Speak up for what's right. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful, beautiful world that we all share.
Because the world is round, it turns me my mind, because
Climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience, but every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.